This is Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Around the corner, ducks down, Ian Book, and we are all tied at 20.
Looney back to Hub for three.
Got it again!
That's a Big Ten Tournament Championship winner!
From 96.1 WSBT.
The Virginia Cavaliers are the national champions.
Here's Yohe with a steal, gives it up, and Johnson throws it down.
Fires, it's caught, touchdown, T.Y. Hilton.
The sports leader.
Decorate! Allow myself to introduce myself. My name is Richie Cunningham, and this is my wife, Oprah.
Your hosts are Eric Hansen and Darren Pritchett.
It is 6 minutes after 5 o'clock from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. Hope you're having a great day. If you're just walking outside in our neck of the woods, might be a little snow in the air right now to welcome you to your car. Nothing too big, but a little snow in the air today. And we've got a little Carolina blue in the area, North Carolina and Notre Dame. College basketball action tonight from Purcell Pavilion. It is a tip-off at 7 o'clock. You can hear the game on WSBT Radio. Pre-game coverage with Jack Nolan and Zach Hillisland comes your way at 6:40 right here on 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. We'll talk some Irish basketball in our next segment, but we're going to talk a little Notre Dame football in this opening segment, and I'm going to talk more about the quarterback position with our Fighting Irish football insider for the South Bend Tribune, Eric Hansen. Coming up later on of the hour, Eric back in the spotlight for the My 5 question of the day. This idea came from your chat the other day at IndyInsider.com. So from all your time covering various events at various newspapers, the craziest finishes to games that Eric has covered in his career. Now, in the chat, you mentioned what number one is.
Right.
And it would be my number one, too, if I had a list. But what are the other four? Plus, what was the number one? We will discuss that coming up in just a little bit during the My 5 question of the day. 6 o'clock hour. Sean and I will focus on the Irish losing to Duke and now getting set for North Carolina. You've got the Astros thing continuing. The commissioner just, it felt like he put his foot in his mouth this weekend. We'll get to that. We've got rapid fire, and we have that Notre Dame-North Carolina matchup. I'm betting there's actually going to be a really good crowd tonight because tickets for these type of games get sold very early in the season. Notre Dame, not where they want to be record-wise. Carolina in uncharted territory right now with their ACC season. It has been a disaster for Roy Williams' team. So I'm betting there's going to be a really good crowd at Purcell Pavilion tonight. Hopefully the students show up in a game that at the start of the year you hope was going to mean a lot, but right now it's just kind of jockeying for position in the middle to the bottom of the ACC. So we have Carolina and Notre Dame coming up tonight at 7 o'clock right here on WSBT Radio. Our program brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. And we're also brought to you by the Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger is a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. Well, I start each day thinking about topics for the program. Today was tough. This was a tough weekend. Because you take a look at the possibilities, you're looking for bright spots, Eric, and it was just one of those weekends where it was tough for everybody, it seems like, in our area. The Irish men's basketball team loses by 34 at Duke, 94-60. The Irish women's basketball team drops a game at Louisville by 33 points, 82-49. The Notre Dame hockey team Friday and Saturday at home taking on Minnesota, led in the third period both nights, but only picked up one of the 6 points possible in the Big Ten standings. Indiana got absolutely drilled in Ann Arbor and looked very uninterested. Purdue lost by double digits at Ohio State. So we got to find that bright spot somewhere. And we'll put a little spotlight on Link Jarrett, won his first two games as Notre Dame baseball coach, as the Irish took 2 out of 3 from the University of Alabama, Birmingham. So nice going, coach. And Notre Dame softball off to a 4-0 start. They won four games down in Raleigh, two times beating Illinois, two times beating Ohio State. So Coach Gump's team off to another great start. That program has been so consistent for so long. So good work by the Irish softball team. But otherwise, boy, this was one of those weekends you just kind of took it on the chin. Hopefully better things ahead. Maybe starting tonight we turn the corner with Notre Dame and North Carolina. We'll talk some Irish hoops in a little bit. I want to jump back into the quarterback conversation we had on Friday here on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat when we were live from the Compton Family Ice Arena. And we got into a discussion about the future of Notre Dame quarterbacks with Tommy Rees being the offensive coordinator and play caller for Notre Dame. Would we see a change in the type of quarterback as you go from Chip Long to Tommy Rees as the offensive coordinator? And I enjoyed that conversation. So now you're getting your quarterbacks to town, and this is something that's popped up a lot the last year or so. I know we've talked about it. Fans have chimed in via email or Twitter or during chats, Eric, asking you about this. But there always seems to be some sort of debate surrounding, A, the reps the backups get, and B, should they be involved as a scout team quarterback rather than learning the Fighting Irish offense, being more with the offense on a daily basis. So I know in the chat the other day, this was brought up. There was reps conversation. You got Ian Book as your starter, and you have to get him ready for the season. That is the most important thing from the quarterback standpoint, getting that number one guy ready to go. But you have to have number two in the best position to succeed. Now, Eric, Brendan Clark is the number two guy, and he was a scout team quarterback last year for this football team. He got a few snaps in during his freshman campaign, but his job was to give the defense the best look possible each week in order to give them the best opportunity to have success. So scout team quarterbacks are extremely important. But Clark, since we have Clark Lee, I should probably say Brendan Clark, he spent a lot of time with the scout team. So he's going to be Phil Dracovic from last year, and that is he's going to be spending a lot of time on the side of the thinking where he's learning the Fighting Irish offense. He's going to be full-time into that offense. And I'm sorry, my computer's going nuts here again. I'm trying to fix it as I'm talking, so I apologize. So you look at Brendan Clark now coming in as the number two guy. Let's just start with this. How do you think the reps will pan out during spring practice? Is it all about getting Ian Book as much time as possible? Or since he's a veteran guy, he knows this system well, new play caller. Now, he spent December in an Iowa State game with that Rees mindset. But how do you think the spring is handled from a rep standpoint at the quarterback position?
I think you still have to invest a lot in Ian Book. And here's why. There's going to be some tweaks to the Notre Dame offense. You also, there's a belief with the Notre Dame coaching staff that there's another level for Ian Book. And I know not the whole fan base agrees with that, but I think that the coaching staff certainly does. And if they're going to do that, they want to get Ian Book, at least at the line of scrimmage, to be Tommy Rees, to be an extension of Tommy Rees. One of the things that people said about Joe Burrow that made him so difficult to prepare for LSU was he became that extension of the coaching staff on the field this year.
Okay.
He wasn't that way his first year as a starter, and Ian Book actually had much better stats in 2017 than Joe Burrow, or 2018 than Joe Burrow did in his first year as a starter. So yeah, I mean, you're going to have Ian Book on the field in the fall playing big downs and high leverage situations, so absolutely, you want him to form chemistry. Plus, you got basically a brand new receiving core. Your mm-hmm. leading returning receiver is Tommy Tremble. So you're talking about a lot of new wide receivers, a lot of new tight ends, and you want to get him as familiar with them. The thing is, you only have three quarterbacks, and you're not in a quarterback competition. Which was the case that really kind of messed up Sean Kizer's spring before he became the starter, because it was between Everett Golson and Malik Zaire, and then Everett Golson ends up leaving, and then Malik breaks his ankle the second game of the season, and Kizer looked terrible in the spring and really didn't get many meaningful reps. So I think the harder question is, how do you divide up the reps between Brendan Clark and Drew Pine? And I think you have to decide whether there's a question about who's number two there. If that's an open competition, then you need to start the spring by being pretty even between the two of them. But my sense is they'll invest in Brendan Clark, and there's nothing wrong with him getting reps with the twos. You know, he's going to get a lot of reps in team periods, a lot in seven-on-sevens, just not as much as Ian Book. But, you know, you want your number two to be ready, but I think you've got to invest in Ian Book.
Eric and Darren with you, SportsBeat on WSBT Radio. So let's take this conversation a step further. There are different levels of quarterbacks that all these teams bring in. Sometimes a quarterback is a filler. He is a guy that comes into the program that probably the coaching staff never anticipates getting on the field, but if there's a transfer, if there's an injury, and you need someone to come in and take over for hopefully just a short amount of time, that person can do that. But they're never going to be probably a player you're going to fully invest in unless they just get a whole lot better while at that university. But then there's also guys you bring in that you feel like could be your starter for, let's say, 3 years. I think it's fair to say, Eric, coaches have to think that way. Because sometimes if you have two great quarterbacks on your roster, you're not going to be able to get a high-level guy in that next class because of the competition there, and kids want to play so quickly. So here's what I'm leading to. The use of the scout team quarterback position. We've just stated it's very important to make sure the defense is ready to go because that scout team quarterback runs the opposing offense. Clark Lee's defense needs to be put in the best position to succeed, and that scout team quarterback can help with his play running the other team's offense. But it also takes away from your time learning the actual Notre Dame offense. So, Eric, do you believe, depending on the level of quarterback, should that be a part of the decision if a guy is just going to learn the offense his freshman year or be a part of that scout team where more of the focus is learning each week's opponent offense? And I guess we could get into a Drew Pine, Tyler Buchner conversation, a guy that will be here in a couple of years if he signs. Buchner.
Right, Tyler Buchner.
Who everybody loves.
Right, who everybody loves. Well, let's look first at the filler thing, because I think Charlie Weiss did think like that. I'm not sure that Brian Kelly looks as much like that.
Okay.
But Brian Kelly inherited Dane Crist and Nate Montana, and then he had to re-recruit Tommy Reese and Andrew Hendricks. They were already committed. He had to get them back on board, and then he added Luke Massa. Massa would probably fit in the filler category, I guess. Then Gunnar Keel was next, or I'm sorry, he transferred next. Everett Golson, Gunnar Keel, Malik Zaire, Deshaun Kizer, Brandon Wimbush, Ian Book, Avery Davis, Phil Jakovic, Brendan Clark, Drew Pine. So of those guys, I don't see a lot of filler in there because I think quarterbacks transfer more often everywhere, and certainly at Notre Dame. I mean, we still have the trivia question, and Ian Book will be a new answer to it. The guys that completed their eligibility at Notre Dame completed it as a quarterback, didn't transfer, didn't go to the NFL early, and didn't change positions, and that's Brady Quinn. This is since Zach Kustak. This is since the end of the Holtz era, so we're talking 23, 24 years. We're talking Brady Quinn, Evan Sharpley, Tommy Reese, and Ian Book will be number four.
Wow. So doesn't that tell you, with so many kids leaving, not just at Notre Dame, but across the country, you see quarterbacks dancing all over the place, isn't a necessity getting those a filler guy every once in a while to help fill that void lost so you don't have that numbers issue?
You would want that, but I don't know that quarterbacks want to do that anymore. And was Avery Davis that guy?
So yeah. They'd rather start at Southern Mississippi rather than being the number three at Notre Dame? Or start at Nicholls State?
Well, I mean, when we look at the transfers, that have happened during the Brian Kelly era. Dane Crist did a fifth year, you know, did the grad thing. He went to Kansas. Andrew Hendricks did the grad thing, went to Miami. Gunner went to Cincinnati, and that was not a grad transfer. Golson, grad transfer, Florida State. Malik Zaire, grad transfer, Florida. Brandon Wimbush, grad transfer, UCF. Avery Davis moved to running back. And then a lot of other places. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, because the next, I think, big opportunity, and Phil Jakovic to Boston College, the next big opportunity for somebody to bolt is when Tyler Buchner lands on campus. And that's going to be 2021. That's when Ian Book is gone. So it'll be Clark, Pine, and Buchner in 2021. If you're, let's say, if you are third on the depth chart coming out of, you know, fall camp, does that cause you to want to transfer? The thing about it is, too, today the ACC backed the Big Ten's assertion that they also feel like kids should be able to transfer the first time without penalty in any sport. So the transfer door being that wide open and not having to get a lawyer anymore, you're going to have more kids transfer because they can play the very next year. And they can kind of survey and see whose depth chart needs help. And but you know, tying it back to the scout team thing, is a walk-on quarterback good enough to give you the looks that you want?
Exactly. And that's part of the question.
And that's the dilemma.
Yes.
Because you look at Notre Dame's defense and they seem prepared. You know, you talk about the pass defense the past 2 years, it's the best two pass efficiency defenses in Notre Dame history. Now, history goes back to like 92. That's when that became a statistic. But you're talking, you know, a good long 27, 28 years, those are the two best pass defenses that Notre Dame's had. Did having these quarterbacks help create that stat? I mean, obviously you have to have good players and a good defensive coordinator. But then, Darren, invariably we get into these transfer situations and somebody all of a sudden becomes the number two, and then when they have to step in, they don't know the Notre Dame offense well enough. When have we heard that? We heard that with Wimbush, because he had done some scout team stuff his sophomore year when he redshirted.
Let's look at it this way. In a perfect world, Ian Book has an unbelievable 2019. He goes to the NFL, and Phil Jakovic becomes a starter, and then Tyler Buchner comes in eventually and probably becomes your scout team quarterback. But with Jakovic gone, does that change the way you look at that possibility?
Yes.
So he can't be your scout team quarterback.
I mean, somebody asked me who I thought the quarterback would be in 2021.
Okay.
I think if you just say raw ability, Buchner is the guy. If you say factor in everything else, how long they've been in the system and so forth, I think Brennan Clark is your guy. I don't see a scenario where Drew Pine rises above those two.
The only other alternative is a grad transfer.
Yes.
To help that bridge to Buchner.
And when you look at what the grad transfer market looked this year, let's say Book had gone and Jakovic left, I mean, you could have got KJ Costello in school here.
Oh, Stanford quarterback,
right? You had Derek King from Houston.
Mm-hmm.
You had Jake Bentley from South Carolina. I don't know if the academic fit was there with Bentley or King. I would assume since they graduated, most likely they would be a fit. You know, it's different than a undergraduate transfer. The person's gotten a degree from an accredited university. But there are some good quarterbacks out there. You could do that. But again, how long will it take them to get the Notre Dame offense? Now, again, those don't always work. Tate Martell went to Miami from Iowa State and got buried down there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other guys that kind of fit that bill too. So
for every Joe Burrow, there's probably two or three.
Right. And I think it matters getting into spring practice or not too. Golson didn't get into spring practice. Zaire didn't get into spring practice, I don't believe. But Phil Jakovic did. So Phil Jakovic is going to be, I think in another week, BC opens their spring practice, and he's going to be able to take reps, and that's going to help going through spring practice. But it's the thing, I guess, where you don't give Notre Dame the benefit of the doubt is quarterback development hasn't been stellar here.
So you'd be shocked if Buckner's the starter his first year here?
No, I wouldn't.
Okay, so you think there is a chance?
I think he's the second most likely scenario because Book's gone.
Right.
So it's Clark, Pine, and Buckner.
Well, again, the grad transfer is a possibility.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm thinking.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay, that's possible. That's possible. Well, I think a lot of it then depends on what we see out of Clark and Pine this year. Pine is an interesting kid. He's here early,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to help him. When I watched him play and watched him in the San Antonio, some of the drills and so forth down there, when you saw film of that, and Carter confirmed this, Carter Carls, our recruiting guy, his arm strength just seems to be lacking. Now, he's accurate. He's a gamer. There's a lot to like about him, but if he can't throw the deep ball at all, that concerns me.
The fortunes of Tommy Reese changed by being able to come to campus early.
It really helped him. Did. You and maybe it would have worked out the same, but you wonder if Andrew Hendricks came early and Tommy Reese didn't. I mean, there's a big difference between those two guys.
Sure.
Reese threw the ball like crazy in high school. He played on a team with a bad defense, and he put up big numbers in the passing game. Andrew Hendricks played for a really good Cincinnati Muller team that ran the ball, just kind of mauled you with their running game, including him. But he had this great arm that you see him in a camp, you go, wow, that's a howitzer. You know, that's and that Brian Kelly kind of fell in love with that. You know, if Andrew had come early and gotten a lot more reps, would he have been as good from the neck up at the line of scrimmage? I think that's where Andrew struggled because he didn't have a lot of opportunities. I mean, this guy's going to be somebody's doctor here in another year or two.
Yeah.
I mean, but Tommy Reese was exceptional in being able to manipulate at the line of scrimmage. Andrew Hendricks was the better athlete. I know when I saw them play at the end of 2011, my vote was for Andrew Hendricks, and I think that ruffled some people's feathers, but I called it like I saw it. And then it ends up being Everett Golson the next year in 2012 because they saw enough of Golson as a true freshman, felt like he kind of got the flakiness out of him of adjusting to Notre Dame, and they went with him. But, you know, when you look at the body of work here, again, the critics will say, who has gotten better during their career? Who's got significantly better? When you look at the statistics, and that's something that Ian Book has a chance to do. He has a chance to be...
Rewrite the script.
Yeah, he has a chance to rewrite the script. And again, maybe Tommy, being the quarterback coach and the offensive coordinator, maybe this is the spot in the Brian Kelly era where everything aligns, where the quarterback development is going to accelerate. I'm not predicting that, but I'm open to that possibility. I think I've been covering Brian Kelly. This is the 11th year that I've been covering him, and this to me is the second most fascinating season. I think 2017 was the most fascinating because of having to come back from the 2016. I think this is more fascinating than 2012 just because 2012 they had such a good defense. This team has to be good on both sides of the ball. And Brian Kelly had a real opportunity with his these coaching hires to upgrade his staff, and he's bound and determined he's going to change recruiting. And it's a fun time to see if all that happens, because you can't say that it won't. I know that there's skeptics that are driving off the road now, and not because of the snow, but but I do think that it's possible. It's a neat time, because if Notre Dame is going to win a national championship, the window is opening right now. The most realistic window is opening right now. And it may not stay open forever, but you've got a lot of momentum in recruiting. You've got a really good roster. You've got a really, really, really good defensive coordinator who's not going to be here much longer. You've got an unbelievable defensive line coach. You're recruiting offensive linemen right and left. You got to get those skill players, and you got to get that quarterback. Now, is Ian Book a top 10 quarterback? Because he's got to be. He's got to go from around 25th. He's 24th. He's got to be a top 10 guy. Do you think he has it in him?
He's an older guy. Gives him a great opportunity. He's seen a lot.
Yeah, there's not a lot of three-year starters in college football anymore. You know, there's been a lot of first-year starters to win national championships in the last decade, and a lot of that is because people either transfer or they're going pro early. You know, DeShone Kizer could have been a four-year starter, but he left 2 years on the table.
Wonder if his NFL career is different had he stayed. That's a debate for another day.
Yeah, I wonder what he thinks.
I would say there's a pretty good chance you come back for another year. Might enhance his skill set going to the NFL.
It would be
can't hurt at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and he had just the absolute worst luck of ending up in Cleveland. I remember talking to Charlie Weiss about it before the draft, and
Brady
I said,
too.
"Yeah." And I said, "Is there any really bad case scenario?" Because Charlie liked Kizer. I go, "Is there any way that this kind of derails and he doesn't turn out to be what we think he could?" He goes to Cleveland. He goes, there's not one positive thing about him ending up there. There's not an older guy to help him there.
Mm-mm.
Bad management, bad coaching. And it turned out to be. And I think, you know, it's kind of hard for DeShone to reinvent himself. He needs a situation where an injury kind of pops him in there and then he plays great. You know, I know that he was pretty happy about playing on the same roster as Aaron Rodgers for a little while.
And when he got the chance to play, it wasn't that great.
Nope. So, but, you know, Notre Dame is, I mean, the one thing that you can say about Kelly, even though there hasn't been great examples of quarterback development over their careers, it's not like he's still using the same template he was using in 2010, 2011, and 2012. He's trying different things. Again, maybe Tommy Reese, maybe this is the hire that puts him over the top. It's really going to be interesting to see what that turns into for me.
Hmm. All right. Spirited quarterback conversation.
Yeah.
Enjoy that. We'll have plenty of quarterback discussion as spring practice gets underway in the next couple of weeks. 26 minutes in front of the top of the hour. We start the program with Notre Dame football conversation on 96.1 WSBT and on the SportsBeat app. And coming up next, we're going to shift gears to Mike Bray's Irish basketball team. Not a pretty second half at Cameron on Saturday. You got a wounded Carolina team coming in. And right now, the resume is crumbling for Notre Dame. We'll get to that coming up in a couple of moments as SportsBeat rolls on. He's Eric. I'm Darren. We're brought to you by Budweiser and the Food Bank of Northern Indiana from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. We're back on Budweiser's weekday SportsBeat. Eric Hansen, Darren Pritchett with you. It is 19 minutes in front of the top of the hour, and we have Notre Dame basketball coming up 1 hour from right now. Jack Nolan will have the pregame of North Carolina at Notre Dame. Opening tip is set for 7 o'clock right here on WSBT Radio. Well, the Irish were within striking distance, at least, of the Duke Blue Devils. on Saturday at Cameron Indoor Stadium, down 42-32 at halftime. But things unraveled rather quickly as the young Blue Devils really got going offensively. They outshot Notre Dame 54% to 28% in the second half. They outscored the Irish 52-28. And Notre Dame, over the last 5-6 minutes of the game, started resting players in anticipation of playing 48 hours later against the North Carolina Tar Heels. It was a game in which the Irish saw Rex Pfluger not make a field goal for a second consecutive game. He was 0-6 against the Dukies. T.J. Gibbs went 0-7 from the field. Those two players did not score in the game. Prentice Hubb only went 2-7 from the field, 6 points, and committed five of the team's 14 turnovers against Duke. The bright spot was Juwan Durham, 21 points in the ballgame. But the guards did not provide Mike Bray a whole lot in this game. So let's hear from Coach Bray, this audio courtesy of Fighting Irish Media. They were down there in Durham, North Carolina, covering the game. First, here was Coach Bray opening up his post-game presser, talking about the 94-60 loss to the Duke Blue Devils.
One league loss. Okay. I can live with that. Wow, they were great. They're fabulous. When they're shooting like that around the big guy, I don't know what to do. And then they really guarded us. We had a hard time getting any look because of their ball pressure. So, for us, the whole last 10 minutes in timeouts, I was talking about Monday night. Because we got to kind of turn around mentally here and get ready to play against North Carolina on Monday and see if we could get out of this stretch that started at Clemson 2-2. If we could do that, I'll take that. That's probably as good as it gets. But they were rolling. And, again, when they shoot it like that from different spots around the big fella, what do? They get to 90, like, so easy.
Well, it was only the fourth time at ACC play that Duke has reached 90 in regulation so far this year. But again, the guard play for Notre Dame really vanished in this particular contest. You look at Pfluger, Hubb, Gibbs, and Goodwin. They combined in this game to make 2 field goals. You're not going to beat Miami or Wake Forest, let alone Duke, when the guards only supply you that type of offense. And Mike Bray, after the game, was asked about his guard play.
I think their ball pressure really bothered us. I'm really pleased. I thought Durham really played well and battled. And, Johnny's Johnny. But we couldn't get anything going from our guards. And I think it was their ball pressure. And they kept a number of bodies, fresh guys on you, where they're pressuring you. We only made 5. I mean, for us to beat, we have to make 10 threes to win league games. And I don't even know if we had 10 great clean looks. Even the looks we got were rushed because of their speed and their closeout stuff.
And I'm going to just add up the numbers again here. Rex, Hubb, TJ, and Goodwin combined to go 3-for-24 from the field. And Duke's defense was good, but I'm not going to give them that much credit. There were shots to knock down, and I think the inability to make plays off the dribble prohibits this offense from really being consistently good or explosive. And I think that holds back this team at times. And the Irish in this particular ball game ended up shooting 36% from the field, but only 26% of the second half. And they were 5 of 21 from the three-point line. And Eric, it's just hard for this team to beat anybody in the ACC making 5 three-point shots. This team is built around guard play, knocking down three-point shots, getting that post guy some touches. And I think we're getting to the point with the way Durham has played that despite the fact 4-out-1-in has been the best formula for years, the two bigs might give them the best opportunity right now. And Durham's kind of been that guy. He's been some games playing a lot, some games not at all. After what I saw Saturday, it's hard to keep him off the floor tonight. And I like the 4-out-1-in. I'm not a fan of the two bigs, because the offense has been so good through the years with four out, one in. But right now, what gives them the best chance to win? I don't know. I'm searching. It might be Durham and Mooney in there together, and I've never been a big fan of that.
Why do you feel like Notre Dame was so one-sided? Because they've been a tough out for a long time, and then it was not even close. I mean, is Duke that much better than them? They run out of gas.
I don't know if anybody in the ACC is 34 points better than Notre Dame, but I mean, Rex is 0 for his last 11 from the field the last two games. Prentice has good games, and he gets a little quiet. Gibbs has been fairly consistent. Eric, I wish I had a better answer for you. I don't think Duke's defense was that great. They're good. They're okay. They're pretty solid, no doubt about it, but I think there were some plays to be made in this game. So, to me, this is kind of the last stand tonight for me. North Carolina is a wounded team. They blew that game against Duke at home. Then they got routed by Wake Forest. I just feel like this is a game Notre Dame should win. Yeah, Cole Anthony is awesome for North Carolina. He's back. Carolina beat him the first time. Got to win at home. If you don't win this game, I don't know if there's a lot really to cheer about until the ACC tournament. Yeah, you're playing for seeding, but the NCAA tournament is just basically a distant conversation. It's just vanishing at this point. And, Eric, right now they're 58 in the net ranking. They're 1-for-6 against their best opponents. That's the quad one games. Quad two, they're 2-3. And, Eric, there's not much arsenal coming up. Carolina's a quad three game. That's it. Miami, quad three. At Boston College, quad three. At Wake Forest, believe it or not, quad two. Florida State at home, quad one. Virginia Tech, quad three. Not many opportunities to get a bang for your buck. So I think we're kind of to the point where the resume conversation is just fantasy world. And it's just about this team trying to get better going into the ACC tournament. Losing to Virginia really changed everything.
Yeah, it did.
It just, that was a game that was a 50-50 game, and you can't get it. Now you look at the games coming up, there's just not a lot that will spark that resume. And again, 1-6 against Quad 1, that hurts. Their strength of schedule is not very good. So we're running out of positives to throw at people, trying to keep hope alive.
You got
to
win. I mean, you'd have to really win the rest of them. Then you'd have at least a Florida State win.
But, Eric, if you go, let's see, if you go 5-1, but the loss is to Florida State, what did that really get you, those five wins?
A better NIT seeding.
Unfortunately, that might be the case. All right, so the Irish and Carolina play coming up at 7 o'clock right here on WSBT Radio. More on the Irish coming up at the top of next hour. My five question of the day is next on WSBT and the Sports Beat.
One question, five answers. This is the My Five Question of the Day on Michiana's Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Okay, as we've talked about many times, besides Notre Dame football, Eric's been on the Big Ten football and basketball beat. He covered Indiana when Bob Knight was the head coach, so he has seen a lot of crazy things, high school sports as well. So today's question, the five craziest finishes to games that Eric has covered in his career. So he had to be at the game, not watching on TV, I guess.
Right.
So this will be a fun list. I'm pretty sure we have the same number one. But let's start with...
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, this is number five.
Well, I don't know that this was a crazy finish, but it was the only finish that I kind of was involved with covering where I felt like a national championship was won that day, and then it wasn't. And it was the Florida State-Notre Dame game in 1993. I was brought on. I was covering the Big Ten at the time. They brought me on for the number two, number one matchup at Notre Dame Stadium. And just the atmosphere at the end of the game, it felt like Notre Dame won a national championship because they beat Florida State. Then they gave it away the next week to Boston College with an upset loss.
Four.
This game wasn't close at all, and the reason it jumped out in my memory was the closing minutes of it. and it was Notre Dame's worst season in their history. They were 1-9 going into the game. They were playing Duke, and they were up late in the game. It was senior day at Notre Dame, and Tom Zbikowski lines up at quarterback, and it was one of the cool things, just the reception, because Tommy thought that people at Notre Dame would hate him forever because of that bad season that he was a part of, and he comes in to play quarterback, and he was a high school quarterback and had always wanted to play quarterback. He finally got to, and then Travis Thomas, I think was the guy's name, fumbled the ball on that, or they would have probably scored.
Craziest finishes to games that Eric has covered in his career.
Oh, okay, okay. Number three.
This one is, to this day, the best meaningless game that I ever covered. IU and Marquette in 1985 are playing the NIT. So this is the year Bobby Knight had thrown the chair. So, and it felt like two great programs that had won national championships were both kind of sliding off basketball's map. And they went at it in that game like it meant everything. And it ended up being a double overtime game. Rick Majerus was Marquette's coach at the time. It was a war of attrition. Kerry Trotter, I can remember when he fouled out in, I want to say, the first overtime. He went to the scoring table and cleared all the papers off. You know, I'm surprised he didn't get a technical for doing it, but he just wiped everybody's paperwork off. But it was just the most intense basketball game to this day that I've covered.
And the Irish and Marquette are going to renew a series in a couple of years. I think the 22-23 season. That old series coming back, and of course they played in the Big East.
Right. Indiana did come back and win a national championship, but Marquette came back too from that game, so it wasn't the end. But Dan Dockich was on that team.
Oh boy.
Number two.
Number two is another basketball game, and it was Indiana-Illinois. And this, Darren thinks it's going to be the one in Champaign-Urbana, but it wasn't.
I'm tired of losing to Purdue!
It did involve the Ludu, but Ludu, Jay Edwards,
yes.
Notre Dame is down 67-65.
Boom!
And he dribbles down. He's almost at the sideline, and he launches this shot that goes over the top of the backboard and into the basket.
And he pushed off.
And it was 67-67, and it showed 1 second left. The refs ended up putting another second on the clock, 2 seconds left, Illinois inbounds.
Stephen Bardo.
To Nick Anderson, who from between about half court and the three-point line launches a three-pointer, and it hits nothing but net. And
35 feet.
Illinois wins 70-67. Incredible. Two of the best shots that I've seen in such a short period of time. That game, I'm sure I've had a lot more like that, but that one is the one that registers in my mind.
That's a great choice. That's much better than when Knight left the floor in Champaign waving at the crowd with seconds left on the clock, led to the classic bully comment.
Yeah, there was a lot where things kind of moved into the post-game press conferences, which would change the list.
Number one.
Number one was the Bush push game.
Yeah, unreal.
Best football game that I've covered, because in the moment where Notre Dame thought the game was over, it felt like Notre Dame football was back all at once. And it really didn't turn out to be, because Charlie Weiss didn't sustain that. But it was in that moment, it was great. And then they said, hey, we got to put time back on the clock. And USC could have kicked a field goal, I think, to tie the game. And instead they went for the touchdown. And, man, the Bush push, which is now legal, was not legal at the time.
I still think the ball was spotted incorrectly before that play because the ball went out of bounds.
Correct. It was fumbled out of bounds. Yeah.
That's my five. Fun list right there. Sports Beat back in a moment. Couple of minutes in front of the top of the hour at WSBT and the Sports Beat.
Welcome back to another hour of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Touchdown, Notre Dame! 70 yards, Book to Lindsey.
He gets it out to Leshesky for three.
Got it! He got it!
Caught for the win! Kyle Rudolph!
From 97.5 96.1 WSBT.
Justin Fisher heading for the touchdown, his sixth of the night.
The Washington Nationals are World Series champions.
And that's a South Bend Cup Midwest League Championship winner.
And the kick is good for the win. Pinheiro with the De Niro kick.
The sports leader.
And look who's coming up.
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
.606 and 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. He's Sean, I'm Darren. Irish basketball coming up. We are 33 minutes away from the pregame. Jack Nolan and Zach Hillisland, courtside at Purcell Pavilion. 7 o'clock, the game begins. The North Carolina Tar Heels taking on the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame. We have rapid fire coming up in just a couple of moments, but we begin with this Notre Dame basketball team. What's going to happen tonight? They take on this Carolina team that is going through a season that normally does not happen in Chapel Hill. It has been an absolute struggle. Carolina just looking for victories right now. They're a team, they're going to have to win the ACC tournament to go to their normal stop in March, the NCAA tournament. Otherwise, I don't remember the last time they've been in the NIT, but I'm sure it's been a few years. So that is the situation. These are two teams that aren't going to make the tournament with their regular season resumes. It's going to have to be ACC tournament title or bust for these two particular squads. And, you know, the Virginia game is going to haunt Notre Dame. That was a very winnable game to keep the momentum going. That would have been five consecutive victories. You lose by one in overtime. You score only 49 points. And then you come back and play a very difficult second half, and you get blown out by Duke, 94-60. So it's a home game. Cole Anthony's going to be out there for North Carolina. They've beaten the Irish earlier this year, 76-65. That was November 6th, the season opener in Chapel Hill. I feel like Notre Dame's the better team right now. They should win this game, but I just hope there isn't a hangover from that second half.
Demoralizing.
Duke.
Yeah.
Less than 48 hours ago.
2010, by the way, was the last time North Carolina missed the NCAA tournament. I don't know. I can't find if they actually went to the NIT that year. But
they should have been in a couple of NITs after the whole fake class thing that they got away with, or not even any postseason tournament for that matter. Oh, but students could also take these fake classes, so let's not put the basketball program under any scrutiny because, well, if students are allowed to take these fake classes, then it was not any different. Oh, my gosh, are you kidding me?
Yes.
If that was Alcorn State.
I wish I was kidding you, but we're not.
If that was Alcorn State or Pepperdine or Hartford, do you think the same penalty happens?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry to go on.
Absolutely not. This is the last place team in the ACC, though, right now. North Carolina is, and they have lost five straight coming into tonight's game. You never would have thought it. Even after getting Cole Anthony back, they have not been able to pick up any W's. They played, of course, they had Duke beat a little bit more than a week ago. Couldn't finish that off. They lost in overtime. They got thumped, and I mean thumped, by Wake Forest right after that last week. And then they just lost to Virginia over the weekend. And Virginia essentially beats everybody by one or two points.
It's amazing.
but they're managing to put some wins together now. They are the team that in the ACC that is starting to put some wins together. Louisville has found ways to lose to some cruddy teams over the last couple of weeks, but Virginia's picking up wins. North Carolina is not. If you're ever going to beat North Carolina in your Notre Dame, tonight is the night. That's the bottom line.
After those last two Louisville games, it makes you wonder about ACC teams in the NCAA tournament.
It
How
does.
Good are they?
Yeah.
Because how good really are they?
Yeah, exactly.
The guys at the top.
The bids might even shrink. It might only end up being three. Who knows?
Irish outscored. Yeah, no kidding. Irish outscored by Duke 52-28 in the second half Saturday. Duke won 94-60 after the game right here on WSBT Radio and the Notre Dame Basketball Network. Zach Hillisland caught up with Mike Bray.
In the locker room here with Coach Bray. Coach, heading into the stretch, you had a very tough four games, and looking ahead, you knew that Duke was going to be a bit of a juggernaut, and we certainly saw that today.
You know, Zach, I look at that score, and I'm just glad it only counted one loss. I mean, that was a thorough beating. Duke was great. We could not keep up. We were thoroughly outclassed and thoroughly outplayed. The last 8 minutes of the game, I just told our team in the huddles to start thinking about Monday, you know, because we've got a quick turnaround. If we could get out of this stretch 2-2 that started on with Clemson, that's as good as it gets for Notre Dame.
With their defensive pressure, especially on the perimeter, is that something that, you know, you can look at on film, but when you get there in person, it's like another level? It seemed like that really bothered the backcourt today.
Yeah, I think their ball pressure was really hard to deal with. You can't really run offense. You're just trying to pass and catch. And we had a couple good sequences, you know, in the first half where we got into a rhythm, especially when we played the smaller lineup. We just need another guard on the floor. They're just, when they're shooting it like that, that's not something they've done a lot. But when they're shooting and then they got the big guy inside, I don't think you can score enough to beat them. They got the 94 easy.
All right, so Cole Anthony, 34 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists. The last time Notre Dame played North Carolina. And again, the Heels won 76-65 in Chapel Hill, 48 minutes away from the tip of Notre Dame and North Carolina. Another continuing storyline is this Astros cheating scandal, and Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, spent some time with ESPN's Carl Ravage. They talked more about this whole scandal, lack of punishment for the players, and there were some eye-popping things from their conversation.
In hindsight, was there any other way to go about this without blanket immunity that would allow you to punish certain players?
You could have made the choice to go with the management people and sort of given them immunity and found out how the players were involved. Whatever dissatisfaction is out there with the grant of immunity to players, I think it would have been 10 times worse if you let the management people off and then tried to go after the players.
The one thing that I do take issue with, the notion that anybody in the Houston organization escaped without punishment. And I think if you look at the faces of the Houston players as they've been out there publicly addressing this issue, they have been hurt by this. They will live with questions about what went on in 2017 and 2018 for the rest of their lives. And frankly, it's rare that for any offense you have a punishment that you will live with for the rest of your life. So I, you know, hope the questions will at least take into account those two thoughts.
That is a guy that is a white-collar suit that has no feel for baseball. None whatsoever. Oh, the Astros' faces. You could see how sad they were. They are laughing to the bank. They've got a World Series ring. Anytime they're going to feel sad about what happened, all they got to do is look at the bling because that didn't get taken away. A piece of metal is what Manfred called
right.
The trophy or the rings, a piece of metal. It shows you he has no feel for the game of baseball. None.
He went from just a couple of weeks ago, I don't know, heroes maybe a little bit too strong, but I mean, I think he was at least looked upon in a good light for kind of laying down the law a little bit, the suspensions of Hinch and Luhnow and at least doing something. I mean, pretty significant suspensions that he had. He's gone from that to he just seems like he is universally despised right now by the players with the comments about the ring being a piece of metal and the trophy and the whole thing. I don't get it. And, you know, the collective bargaining agreement, of course, expires after not this season but next season. And I cannot see negotiations going very well at this point with the things that he is saying right now.
Incredible. More on that as we continue on, because more people are going to talk about this. Sports Center update brought to you by Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing. Contact Steve Miller in Mishawaka or Greg Langhofer in New Carlisle. As we just talked about, Notre Dame, North Carolina coming up at the top of the hour here on WSBT Radio. The Irish women lost at Louisville yesterday, 82-49. They will host Virginia Tech Thursday at 8. And former Notre Dame basketball player Allie Patberg, Big Ten Player of the Week for Indiana. Wow. How about this in two games? 19.5 points, 7.5 assists, and 4 rebounds. Former Miss Basketball. Doing some good things for Indiana.
No kidding.
All right, we continue on with Rapid Fire next on WSBT and the SportsBeat app.
The South Bend Cubs begin defense of their Midwest League Championship when they host Lake County Thursday, April 9th at 7:05 on 96.1 WSBT. The sports leader.
Rapid Fire starts now on Budweiser's weekday sports beat on 96.1 WSBT. Here is Sean Stiers and Darren Pritchett.
All right, Darren, fill in the blank on this first one. When you think of white men can't jump, you think blank.
The famous line, it's so pretty. Oh, it's a good classic.
It's hard
movie.
Making something this pretty look so bad.
Yeah, Wesley Snipes, Woody Harrelson play off each other great in that particular movie. And what a brilliant idea for Pat Connaughton to dress up like Woody Harrelson's character.
Exactly, Billy Hoyle.
For the slam dunk contest the other night. That was terrific. But that's a good old-fashioned basketball movie on the opposite end of the spectrum of Hoosiers, to say the least.
Yeah.
But it's a fun movie on a day in which there's not much on. That's on. You probably watch it for a few minutes.
Well, and I was thinking more that it would lead to where you just talked about, the fact that Pat Connaughton went with the white man can't jump theme in the NBA slam dunk contest. Now, I didn't get to actually see it live because I was doing a basketball game that night, but I got to see the videos and all that kind of stuff on Twitter. And it was pretty cool because he dressed up the same way Woody Harrelson did. He had the hat on backwards. He had tried to get the same kind of t-shirt and those jams or OP or whatever those shorts were that everyone was wearing back then. They were almost kind of like a Hawaiian looking kind of short.
Jumping, stretching exercises. I think Woody Harrelson did that
if
I'm not mistaken.
He did. That's right. Because Woody essentially dumbed himself down, you know, out there on the court because he was trying to hustle Wesley Snipes and all the guys out there on the playground court. So it was pretty good. And I think that's kind of where Pat was going with his whole thing as well, because, I mean, his whole career, and even before his career started, leading up to the draft, these draft analysts and all these experts, you know, deceptively athletic and, you know, even some saying that he lacks the athleticism to play in the NBA, and it's all along the lines of the stereotype. So I thought that Pat getting his first opportunity to be in the NBA slam dunk contest really, really played it up by going with the white man can't jump theme. And then he had Christian Yelich out there to boot with him.
I thought it was interesting with all the minor league writers and individuals who cover baseball on Twitter, that became a storyline. Wow, he played on a Notre Dame team with Trey Mancini and Kevin Biggio.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good Notre Dame squad right there if you start with those three.
That's true.
They didn't have the success because of the depth of the roster, but that's a pretty good start for a college team.
That, man, and I hadn't even thought about it that way, but that's a really good point. Those three guys were playing college baseball together at Notre Dame. Not bad. Not much depth of pitching staff, though, like you said, after that.
Biggio has really stepped up his game since he played at Notre Dame.
He has.
I mean, now they've got him penciled in as the number two hitter and second baseman for Toronto this year. He's going to hit between Bo Bichette and Vlad Guerrero Jr.
Yep.
So some great opportunities for him.
Absolutely. Good stuff. Speaking of Notre Dame baseball, fill in the blank on this next one as well. Notre Dame baseball took two out of three games from Alabama Birmingham in their season opening series this weekend, and that is blank.
Well, it's a good start for the Link Jarrett era, that's for sure. I'm not sure how good or how bad Alabama Birmingham is, but at this stage of the Notre Dame rebuild, you grab wins when you can get them, so that's a good start. Batting average doesn't mean as much as it used to. They hit .257, but the on base was good, .366. And I love the fact the offense only had 9 strikeouts, so that's a positive sign.
Yeah, I mean, there was some good stuff. They hit 4 home runs on the weekend. Nico Cavadas, the Penn graduate, hit a home run. Gilgenbach, the guy who's been belting home runs for the last few years, hit a home run. They got a nice start. Just a 4.5 ERA for the weekend. They did give up some runs, but the Friday starter, Tommy Sheehan, started the weekend off with 7 shutout innings, gave up just a hit in the opener, so that's a good sign. They just along the lines of what we've been talking about when we talked about Notre Dame baseball these last couple of years, the opportunities we've had, they've got to obviously get some more depth of pitching. Just like, when, you know, Pat Connaughton couldn't do it alone. Tommy Sheehan can't do it alone. A lot of these guys. One thing that I hope they get away from in the future, though, Darren, is this playing of the 3-game series at these group of 5 teams. That's something, going back to Paul Maneri, the sort of the strategy and scheduling that he had. And I realize there's obviously been some distancing from Paul Maneri by the administration and coaches and stuff like that over there. One thing that he used to tell me is you don't play these three-game series to start off the season. You go on the road, you play a two-game set with somebody, or you go to an event where maybe you get two games with one team, two games with another team, because when you play a three-game series, now they won this one, so it doesn't matter, and it's good for them, but when you play a three-game series, if you lose two out of the three, even though you win one of those games, but if you lose two out of three, you don't get RPI credits on the back end. But if you split a two-game series with the team, you still get at least partial RPI credits. And I just think this is a Power 5 team, Notre Dame. You have to get away from going on the road and playing these three-game sets against these Group of Five type programs and these smaller programs in the South. Work something out, get another team involved, play a couple games against a couple teams, do something like that. Get away from these three-game series because you're Notre Dame, you're an ACC program, you're a Group of Five, or you're a Power Five program.
How far in advance is a baseball schedule made in the collegiate game?
A year to 2 years because, you know, the coaches have really almost unlimited control, you know, within the Board of Trustees still has to approve it, you know, in terms of missing school dates and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, the coaches have a lot of control over the schedule that they're able to set, and it's usually able to do it just a year or two, you know, just like Michigan and Vanderbilt. They played in the national championship series last year. They played over the weekend down in Arizona.
Little tournament.
Yeah, exactly.
So could Link change anything on the schedule since he arrived?
Well, that would be tough to do, and I'm not putting it on him.
That's why I'm asking. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, if probably by the time he got hired in July, it was too late to get anything like that done. But I would like to see that for the future, because you've got to start treating yourself like, okay, we're a Power 5 team. We can set some of this stuff. We're an ACC program where you know, if they get to where they want to go, every little thing is going to matter when it comes to getting an NCAA bid at the end of the season in May once you're done with your ACC schedule.
Okay.
So, okay, there's an old theory that says any publicity is good publicity. Darren, do you think that applies to all the Major League Baseball in regards to what's going on with the Houston Astros? Any publicity is good publicity?
Well, there's a lot of clicks for a lot of baseball outlets right now.
That's a very good point.
That's a positive. I'm just really happy that a lot of Major League players that are not Houston Astros are speaking up and showing their displeasure that the Astro players were not suspended in any way for cheating, at least in the 2017 season. What I think is going to be remarkable, and this is going to be a huge topic once it happens, and you know it's going to happen, is, let me just pick an example. The Oakland A's. One of their pitchers drills an Astro, whether it's on purpose or not. Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, has pointed out, and we just talked about this, that Manfred says if you intentionally hit an Astro, there'll be consequences. So here's what you're telling me. Let's say the A's pitcher is Sean Steyers. So you hit the Astro, whether it was on purpose or not. But if Major League Baseball deems you did it on purpose, you will get suspended and fined. But the players for the Houston Astros that cheated during the playoffs and the World Series to win a championship,
nothing happens
get
to them.
Nothing.
Yeah.
It's going to be very difficult for me to understand how that is the right thing to do.
And how are you going to judge intent? You know, all you can do, any game the Astros are involved in, all you can do if you're an umpire in that situation, the first guy that gets hit, you've got to issue warnings to both benches, and then after that, you've got ejections. But you're absolutely right. The Astros are putting everyone else into these situations, because how are you going to judge intent when any of this stuff happens?
Here's the thing. If you look at it from a different perspective, it's a union player hitting a union player.
Yeah, that's true.
It's guys from the same union, so yeah. Why can't they just hash this out themselves without the white-collar guys getting involved in this whole thing?
Absolutely.
Let the union guys figure it out. They're all hold the same card.
Yeah.
They can figure it out, yeah. Right?
Absolutely. You know, and I just look at it where I think sports in general are better when you have a villain. And suddenly the Houston Astros almost overnight. You know, if you go back to 2 months ago when the calendar struck 2020, nobody was talking about this. Since this story broke in, what, early January to where it is right now with spring training started, the Astros have become the biggest villain in sports. And even though Major League Baseball doesn't want this, the Astros obviously don't want this, I think indirectly this is going to work out for the better for Major League Baseball, because now you have a villain, and when those kind of things that you're talking about right there, anything that happens with the Houston Astros over the course of this season, it's going to be big news, and there's going to be a lot of attention on it. Fans now, even casual fans, you know, are turning on the Astros. They're going to hate the Astros. Just think about it. Like when the Raiders were big, the Patriots right now, when the Yankees were winning all these titles. Villains are good for sports, and that's what the Astros have become, the biggest villain in sports. They're, you can argue that they're an even bigger villain than the New England Patriots, who have far more titles than they have. The Astros have one title, but they're the biggest villain in sports right now.
We have finally found a scenario where we're all going to root for the Yankees, of all things, when they play Houston. I mean,
think about that. Think about it.
Here's the funny thing, and I don't remember the national baseball writer, but a player, a major league player, off the record said, if you really want to get the Astros, you don't hit them. Now, what I'm about to say is Fantasy Island stuff, but play along. The suggestion from this player off the record was, we should forfeit all 81 games when you play in Houston. That way the Astros get absolutely zero revenue from any of those games because they have to give back the money because there's no game.
That's true.
Now again, Fantasy Island, but at this stage, that's a heck of an idea. A, the Astros make the playoffs without a problem, and B, it's not very realistic, but that's a heck of an idea.
They'd probably have fans suing them because the, you know, fans have bought, you know, season ticket holders and that kind of stuff. That would be funny, actually. All right, do we have time for one more?
Absolutely.
Okay, one more. Sounds like former Michigan coach John Beilein is not going to make it through his first season with the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers. Scale of 1 to 10, how surprised are you that it has gone this poorly for Mr. Beilein so quickly?
Well, I'm just surprised he left the college game because he's a perfect college coach, had great success at all levels. It sounded like this was his last challenge, and I think he filled up the bank account. But he was making, I'm sure, really good money in Ann Arbor coaching Michigan. Mm-hmm. So I was surprised he left for the NBA. There's some guys it feels like should be college coaches. Others should be NBA. Yeah, Calipari and Patino, they always felt like NBA coaches. But John's a great teacher, and teachers should stay in the college game. I thought he was great for the college game. And if this all plays out the way we think it's going to, some Power 5 conference school is going to be a beneficiary of Beilein coming back to the college game. He's 67, but I think he still has a lot left in the tank.
I think so, too. And the Cavs are just 14-40, and I don't think anyone thought that they were going to win a bunch of games by any means, because they obviously don't have LeBron. He was left with a roster of young guys, and I think that was part of Cleveland's attraction to him. It's like, we've got a young roster. We can get this college coach who's used to working with young guys. You know, he coached up some kind of unsung prospects, turned out a lot of NBA guys when he was with Michigan. Relationships are such a big part of the deal right now, and it appeared that he had good relationships with his guys when he was in Michigan, but it just has not worked out in Cleveland. And I'm like you, I was surprised that he decided to make that jump to the NBA. He is 67 years old, so it's, but it, kind of what you were saying, maybe he was just looking at it like, okay, I am 67. I've been doing this for 40-plus years in college. I'll kind of try that next challenge out there. It just didn't work out for him.
I do remember being told he was frustrated by college basketball recruiting. He lost a Michigan recruit early to the NBA because that person got bad advice. So I think the frustrations of the college basketball NBA relationship might have sent him that way. But I hope he comes back to the college game. And I think there are a lot of institutions across the country that would be very happy to have John Beilein. And if this might have happened a year or two later, that would have been a perfect situation for Indiana University.
Oh, no doubt. It's going to be...
Supposedly he was in line for the job when they took, I want to say it was Kelvin Sampson.
Really?
That was the rumor.
I mean, I would have to imagine if he is indeed done with the Cavaliers before the end of the season, I mean, he is going to be the belle of the ball at the Final Four when the coaches go down there for their convention. Yeah. I mean, I would think that schools, that there are a lot of schools that are going to be getting in line to hire John Beilein. I mean, look at my alma mater, Kansas. There's still all these rumors that maybe Bill Self is going to head out after this year. Who knows? I mean, they could do a heck of a lot worse than hiring John Beilein if Bill Self does take off. Any school could.
All right, that'll do it for Rapid Fire. That'll do it for Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat for tonight, brought to you by the Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger is a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. And Budweiser, great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. Irish basketball next on WSBT South Bend.